A heart to heart. Glada had them fight twice more. Each duel was shorter than the last, and each resulted in a draw, which frustrated the Golden Dragon more than it did Aragorn or Arya. Glada would have kept them sparring until it became abundantly clear who was the better warrior, but by the end of the last duel they were both so tired that they dropped to the ground and lay side by side, heaving for air. And even Glada had to admit that it would be counterproductive, if not downright harmful, for them to continue. Once they had recovered enough to stand and walk, Glada summoned them to Aragorn's tent. First, with energy from Saphira, they healed their more painful injuries. Then they returned their ruined shields to the Varden's weapon master, Frederick, who provided them with replacements, although only after lecturing them on how they ought to take better care of their equipment. When they arrived at the tent, they found Nasawada waiting for them, along with her usual accompaniment of guards. "It's about time," she said in a tart voice. "If the two of you are done trying to batter each other to pieces, we need to talk." Without another word, she ducked inside. Blodgarm and his fellow spellcasters arranged themselves in a large circle around the tent, which Aragorn could tell made Nasawada's guards uneasy. Aragorn and Arya followed Nasawada into the tent. Then Saphira surprised them by pushing the front of her head past the entrance flaps and promptly filling the cramped space with the smell of smoke and burnt meat. The sudden appearance of Saphira's scaly snout took Nasawada aback, but she quickly recovered. Addressing herself to Aragorn, she said, "That was Glada, I felt, wasn't it?" He glanced toward the front of the tent, hoping that her guards were too far away to hear, then nodded. "It was." "Ah, I knew it," she exclaimed, sounding satisfied. Then her expression became uncertain. "May I speak with him? Is it allowed? Or will he only communicate with an elf or a rider?" Aragorn hesitated and looked to Arya for guidance. "I don't know," he said. "He still hasn't entirely recovered. He may not want to..."
"I will speak with you, Nasawada, daughter of Ajahad," Glada said, his voice echoing in their heads. "Ask of me what you will. Then leave us to our work. There is much that still needs to be done in order to prepare Aragorn for the challenges ahead."
Aragorn had never seen Nasawada look awestruck before, but now she did.
"Where?"
she mouthed, and spread her hands. He pointed at a patch of dirt by his bed. Nasawada raised her eyebrows, then she nodded, and drawing herself up, she formally greeted Glada. An exchange of pleasantries followed, during the course of which Nasawada inquired after Glada's health and asked if there was anything the Varden could provide him with. In response to the first question, which had made Aragorn nervous, Glada politely explained that his health was just fine, thank you, and as far as the second matter went, he needed nothing from the Varden, though he appreciated her concern.
"I no longer eat," he said. "I no longer drink, and I no longer sleep as you would understand it. My only pleasure now, my only indulgence, lies in contemplating how I might bring about Galbatorix's downfall."
"That," said Nasawada, "I can understand, for I feel much the same." Then she asked Glada if he had any advice as to how the Varden could capture Drasleona without it costing them an unacceptable amount of men and materiel, as well as, in her words, "handing over Aragorn and Saphira to the Empire like so many trussed-up chickens." She spent some time explaining the situation to Glada in greater specificity, whereupon, after due consideration, he said,
"I have no easy solution for you, Nasawada. I will continue to think on it. But at the moment, I cannot see a way clear for the Varden. If Murtagh and Thorn were by themselves, I might easily overcome their minds. However, Galbatorix has given them too many Eldonari for me to do that. Even with Aragorn, Saphira, and the elves to help, victory would be no sure thing."
Visibly disappointed, Nasawada was silent for a brief while. Then she pressed her hands flat against the front of her dress and thanked Glader for his time. She bade them farewell and took her leave, stepping carefully around Saphira's head so as not to touch her. Aragorn relaxed somewhat as he sat on his cot, while Arya seated herself on a short three-legged stool. He wiped his palms on the knees of his trousers, for his hands felt sticky, as did the rest of him, then offered Arya a drink from his water-skin, which she gratefully accepted. When she was finished, he gulped down several mouthfuls himself. Their sparring had left him ravenous. The water stifled the growls and rumbles coming from his stomach, but he hoped that Glader would not detain them for much longer. The sun had nearly set, and he wanted to get a hot meal from the Varden's cooks before they damped their fires and turned in for the night. Otherwise he knew he would end up gnawing on stale bread, dried strips of meat, mouldy sheep cheese, and if he was lucky, a raw onion or two. Hardly an appealing prospect. Once they were both settled, Glader began to speak, lecturing Aragorn on the principles of mental combat. These Aragorn was already familiar with, but he listened closely, and when the Golden Dragon told him to do something, he followed Glader's instructions without question or complaint. They soon progressed beyond maxims to applied practice. Glader started by testing Aragorn's defences with attacks of ever-increasing strength, which then led them to engaging in all-out battles where they each struggled to obtain dominance, even if only for a moment, over the other's thoughts. While they fought, Aragorn lay on his back with his eyes closed, all of his energies concentrated inward on the tempest that raged between him and Glader. His earlier exertions had left him weak and thick-headed, whereas the Golden Dragon was fresh and well-rested, in addition to being immensely powerful. And that made it difficult for Aragorn to do much more than foil Glader's attacks. Nevertheless, he managed to hold his own reasonably well, knowing that in a real fight, the winner would have undoubtedly been Glader. Fortunately, Glader made some allowances for Aragorn's condition, although, as he said,
"You must be ready to defend your innermost self at any given moment, even when you are sleeping. It may very well be that you will end up facing Galbatorix or Murtagh when you are as exhausted as you are now."
After two more bouts, Glader withdrew to the role of a very vocal spectator, while he had Arya take his place as Aragorn's antagonist. She was just as tired as Aragorn, but he quickly found that when it came to a wizard's duel, she was more than his equal. It did not surprise him. The one time before they had clashed in their minds, she had almost killed him, and that was when she was still drugged from her captivity in Gilead. Glader's thoughts were disciplined and focused, but even he could not match the iron-bound control Arya exerted over her consciousness. Her self-mastery was a trait Aragorn had noticed was common among the elves. Foremost in that regard had been Oromis, who it seemed to Aragorn had been in such perfect command of himself, never the slightest doubt or worry had bothered him. Aragorn considered the elves' restraint an innate characteristic of their race, as well as a natural outcome of their rigorous upbringing, education, and use of the ancient language. Speaking and thinking in a language that prevented one from lying, and every word of which contained the potential to unlock a spell, discouraged carelessness in thought or speech, and fostered an aversion to allowing one's emotions to sweep one away. As a rule, then, elves possessed far more self-control than the members of other races. He and Arya wrestled with their minds for a few minutes, he seeking to escape her all-encompassing grip, she seeking to pin and hold him so that she could impose her will on his thoughts. She caught him several times, but he always wiggled free after a second or two, though he knew had she meant him harm, it would have been too late to save himself. And the whole time their minds were touching, Aragorn was aware of the wild strains of music that wafted through the dark spaces of Arya's consciousness. They lured him away from his own body and threatened to snare him in a web of strange and eerie melodies that had no counterparts among earthly songs. He would have happily succumbed to the bewitchment of the music had it not been for the distraction of Arya's attacks and the knowledge that humans did not often fare well if they became too fascinated with the workings of an elf's mind. He might escape unscathed. He was a rider, after all. He was different. But it was a risk he was not willing to take, not so long as he valued his sanity. He had heard that delving into Blodgam's mind had reduced Nasawada's guard Garvan to a slack-jawed dreamer. So he resisted the temptation, hard as it was. Then Gleda had Saphira join the fray, sometimes in opposition to Aragorn, and sometimes in support of him, for as the Elder Dragon said,
"You must be as skilled in this as Aragorn, Brightscales."
The addition of Saphira substantially altered the outcome of their mental struggles. Together, she and Aragorn were able to fend off Arya with regularity, if not ease. Their combined might even allowed them to subdue Arya on two separate occasions. When Saphira was allied with Arya, however, the two of them so outstripped Aragorn that he gave up any attempt at offense and instead retreated deep inside himself, curling into a tight ball like a wounded animal, while he recited scraps of verse and waited for the waves of mental energy they hurled at him to subside. Lastly, Gleda had them pair off, he with Arya and Aragorn with Saphira, and they fought a duel like that, as if they were two sets of riders and dragons met in combat. For the first few strenuous minutes, they were fairly matched, but in the end, Gleda's strength, experience and cunning, combined with Arya's rigorous proficiency, proved too much for Aragorn and Saphira to overcome, and they had no choice but to concede defeat. Afterward, Aragorn sensed discontent emanating from Gleda. Stung by it, he said, "We'll do better tomorrow, Master." Gleda's mood darkened further. Even he seemed weary from their practice.
"You did well enough, youngling. I could not have asked any more from either of you had you been placed under my wing as apprentices in Vroengard. However, it is impossible for you to learn what you need to learn in a matter of days or weeks. Time gushes between our teeth like water, and soon it will all be gone. It takes years to master the art of fighting with your mind. Years and decades and centuries. And even then, there is still more to learn, more to discover. About yourself, about your enemies, and about the very underpinnings of the world."
With an angry growl, he fell silent. "Then we will learn what we can, and let fate decide the rest," said Aragorn. "Besides, Galbatorix may have had 100 years to train his mind, but it has also been over 100 years since you last taught him. He's sure to have forgotten something in the interim. With you helping us, I know we can beat him." Gleda snorted.
"Your tongue grows ever smoother, Aragorn Shadeslayer."
Nevertheless, he sounded pleased. He admonished them to eat and rest, and then withdrew from their minds and said no more. Aragorn was sure that the Golden Dragon was still watching them, but Aragorn could no longer feel his presence, and an unexpected sense of emptiness settled over him. A chill crept through his limbs, and he shivered. He, Saphira, and Arya sat in the darkening tent, none of them willing to speak. Then, rousing himself, Aragorn said,
"He seems better."
His voice creaked from disuse, and he again reached for the water skin.
"This is good for him," said Arya. "You are good for him. Without something to give him purpose, his grief would have killed him. That he has survived at all is impressive. I admire him for it. Few beings, human, elf, or dragon, could continue to function rationally after such a loss."
"Brom did."
"He was equally remarkable."
"If we kill Galbatorix and Shrukan, how do you think Gleda will react?"
Saphira asked.
"Will he keep going, or will he just stop?"
Arya's pupils reflected a shimmer of light as she looked past Aragorn towards Saphira.
"Only time will tell. I hope not. But if we are triumphant in Urubain, it may very well be that Gleda will find he is no longer able to continue on his own without Oromis. We can't just let him give up."
"I agree."
"It is not our place to stop him if he decides to enter the void," Arya said sternly. "The choice is his to make, and his alone."
"Yes, but we can reason with him and try to help him see that life is still worth living."
She was still for a while, her face solemn. Then she said, I do not want him to die. No elf does. However, if every waking moment is a torment to him, then won't it be better for him to seek release?
Neither Aragorn nor Saphira had an answer for her. The three of them continued to discuss the day's events for a short while longer. Then Saphira pulled her head out of the tent and went to sit on the neighbouring patch of grass.
I feel like a fox with her head stuck down a rabbit hole, she complained. It makes my scales itch, not being able to see if someone is creeping up on me.
Aragorn expected Arya to leave as well, but to his surprise she stayed, seemingly content to sit and talk with him about this and that. He was only too eager to comply. His earlier hunger had vanished during his bouts of mental combat with her, Saphira, and Gleda, and in any case he was more than willing to forego a hot meal in exchange for the pleasure of her company. Night closed in around them, and the camp grew ever quieter as their conversation meandered from one topic to another. Aragorn felt giddy from exhaustion and excitement, almost as if he had drunk too much mead, and he noticed that Arya also seemed more at ease than normal. They talked of many things, of Gleda and of their sparring, of the siege of Dras Leona and what might be done about it, and of other less important matters, such as the crane Arya had seen hunting among the rushes by the edge of the lake, and the scale Saphira had lost from her nose, and how the season was turning and the days were again growing colder. But always they returned to the one topic that was ever present in their thoughts, and that was Galbatorix and what awaited them in Urabain. While they speculated, as they had so many times before, about the types of magical traps Galbatorix might have set for them and how best to avoid them, Aragorn thought of Saphira's question about Gleda, and he said, Arya?
Yes?
She drew the word out, her voice rising and falling with a faint lilt.
What do you want to do once this is all over? If we're still alive, that is. What do you want to do?
He fingered Brisinga's pommel as he considered the question.
I don't know. I haven't let myself think much past Urabain.
It would depend on what she wants, but I suppose Saphira and I might return to Palancar Valley. I could build a hall on one of the foothills of the mountains. We might not spend much time there, but at least we would have a home to return to when we weren't flying from one part of Alagazia to another. He half smiled. I'm sure there will be plenty to keep us busy, even if Galbatorix is dead. But you still haven't answered my question. What will you do if we win? You must have some idea. You've had longer to think about it than I have.
Arya drew one leg up onto the stool, wrapped her arms around it, and rested her chin on her knee. In the dim half-light of the tent, her face appeared to float against a featureless black background, like an apparition conjured out of the night.
I have spent more time among humans and dwarves than I have among the Elfakin, she said, using the elves' name in the ancient language. I have grown used to it, and I would not want to return to live in Ellesmere. Too little happens there. Centuries can slip by without notice while you sit and stare at the stars. No, I think I will continue to serve my mother as her ambassador. The reason I first left Duweldenvarden was because I wanted to help right the balance of the world. As you said, there will still be much that needs doing if we manage to topple Galbatorix. Much that needs putting right. And I would be a part of it.
Ah. It was not exactly what he had hoped she might say, but at least it presented the possibility that they would not entirely lose contact after Urabain, and that he would still be able to see her now and then. If Arya noticed his discontent, she gave no sign of it. They talked for another few minutes. Then Arya made her excuses and rose to leave. As she stepped past him, Aragorn reached toward her as if to stop her, then quickly drew back his hand.
Wait, he said softly, unsure of what he hoped for, but hoping nevertheless. The beat of his heart increased, pounding in his ears, and his cheeks grew warm.
Arya paused with her back to him by the entrance of the tent.
Good night, Aragorn, she said.
Then she slipped out between the entrance flaps and vanished into the night, leaving him to sit alone in the dark.
Discovery. The next 3 days passed quickly for Aragorn, if not for the rest of the Varden, who remained mired in lethargy. The standoff with Dras Leona continued unabated, although there was some excitement when Thorn altered his customary location from above the front gates to a section of the rampart several hundred feet to the right. After much discussion, and after consulting extensively with Saphira, Nasawada and her advisers concluded that Thorn had relocated for no other reason than comfort. The other section of rampart was somewhat flatter and longer. Aside from that, the siege lumbered on without change. Meanwhile, Aragorn spent the mornings and evenings studying with Gleda, and the afternoons sparring with Arya and several other elves. His matches with the elves were not as long or strenuous as his previous one with Arya, for it would have been foolish to push himself that hard every day. But his sessions with Gleda were as intense as ever. The ancient dragon never flagged in his efforts to improve Aragorn's skills and knowledge, and he made no allowances for mistakes or exhaustion. Aragorn was pleased to find that he was finally able to hold his own when dueling with the elves. But it was mentally taxing, for if his concentration lapsed for even a moment, he would end up with a sword jabbed in his ribs or pressed against his throat. With his lessons from Gleda, he made what would have been considered exemplary progress under normal circumstances, but given the situation, both he and Gleda were frustrated with the pace of his learning. On the second day, during his morning lesson with Gleda, Aragorn thought to say, "Master, when I first arrived at the Varden in Farthendur, the twins tested me. They tested my knowledge of the ancient language and of magic in general."
"You told this to Oromis. Why repeat it to me now?"
"Because it occurred to me, the twins asked me to summon the true form of a silver ring. At the time, I didn't know how. Arya explained it to me later. How with the ancient language, you can conjure up the essence of any thing or creature. Yet Oromis never spoke of it, and I was wondering, why not?"
Gleda seemed to sigh.
"Summoning the true form of an object is a difficult kind of magic. In order for it to work, you must understand everything of importance about the object in question, even as you must in order to guess the true name of a person or animal. Furthermore, it's of little practical value, and it's dangerous, very dangerous. The spell cannot be structured as a continuing process that you can end at any time. Either you succeed in summoning the true form of an object, or you fail and die. There was no reason for Oromis to have you try anything so risky, nor were you advanced enough in your studies to even discuss the topic."
Aragorn shuddered inwardly as he realized just how angry Arya must have been with the twins to summon the true form of the ring they held. Then he said, "I would like to try it now." Aragorn felt the full force of Gleda's attention focused on him.
"Why?"
"I need to know if I have that level of understanding, even if only for one small thing."
"Again, why?"
Unable to explain with words, Aragorn poured his jumble of thoughts and feelings into Gleda's consciousness. When he finished, Gleda was silent for a while, digesting the flow of information.
"Am I right to say," began the dragon, "that you equate this with defeating Galbatorix? You believe that if you can do this and live, then you might be able to defeat the king?"
"Yes," said Aragorn, relieved. He had been unable to articulate his motivation as clearly as the dragon, but that was exactly it.
"And you are determined to try this?"
"Yes, master."
"It may kill you,"
Gleda reminded him.
"I know."
"Aragorn,"
exclaimed Saphira, her thoughts faint in his mind. She was flying high above the camp, watching for possible danger, while he studied with Gleda.
"It's far too dangerous. I won't allow it."
"I have to do this," he replied quietly.
To Saphira, but also to Aragorn, Gleda said,
"If he insists, then it is best he tries where I can watch. If his knowledge fails him, I may be able to supply the needed information and save him."
Saphira growled, an angry ripping sound that filled Aragorn's mind. And then from outside the tent, Aragorn heard a fearsome rush of air and startled cries from men and elves as she dove to the ground. She landed with such force, the tent and everything in it shook. A few seconds later, she stuck her head into the tent and glared at Aragorn. She was panting, and the wind from her nostrils ruffled his hair and made his eyes water from the odor of burnt meat.
"You're as thick-headed as a cull," she said.
"No more than you."
Her lip curled in a hint of a snarl.
"Why are we waiting? If you must do this, let us be done with it." "What will you choose to summon?"
asked Gleda.
"It must be something you are intimately familiar with."
Aragorn let his gaze drift over the interior of the tent, then down to the sapphire ring he wore on his right hand.
Arryn.
He had rarely taken the ring off since Arjahad had given it to him from Brom. It had become a part of his body as surely as his arms or legs. During the hours he had spent looking at it, he had memorized every curve and facet, and if he closed his eyes, he could call up an image that was a perfect reproduction of the actual object. But for all that, there was much he did not know about the ring, its history, how the elves had made it, and ultimately, what spells might or might not be woven into its fabric.
"No, not Arryn."
Then his gaze slid from the ring to the pommel of Brisinga, where the sword stood leaning against the corner of his cot.
"Brisinga," he murmured.
A muffled whump emanated from the blade, and the sword rose a half inch out of its scabbard, as if pushed from beneath, and small tongues of flame leaped up from the mouth of the sheath, licking the underside of the hilt. The flames vanished, and the sword slid back into the scabbard as Aragorn quickly ended the unintentional spell.
"Brisinga," he thought, utterly certain of his choice. It had been Runan's skill that had crafted the sword, but it was he who had wielded the tools, and he had been joined with the elf smith's mind throughout the process. If there was any one object in the world he understood through and through, it was his sword.
"Are you sure?"
asked Gleda. Aragorn nodded, then caught himself as he remembered the golden dragon could not see him.
"Yes, master. A question, though. Is Brisinga the true name of the sword? And if not, do I need its true name for the spell to work?"
"Brisinga is the name of fire, as you well know. The true name of your sword is undoubtedly something far more complicated, although it might very well include Brisinga within its description. If you wish, you could refer to the sword by its true name, but you could just as easily call it sword and achieve the same result, so long as you maintain the proper knowledge at the forefront of your mind. The name is merely a label for the knowledge, and you do not need the label in order to make use of the knowledge. It is a subtle distinction, but an important one. Do you understand?"
"I do."
"Then proceed as you will."
Aragorn took a moment to collect himself. Then he found the nub in the back of his mind and reached through it to tap his body's store of energy, channeling that energy into the word he spoke. While also thinking about everything he knew of the sword, he said clearly and distinctly,
"Brisinga!"
Aragorn felt his strength ebb precipitously. Alarmed, he tried to speak, tried to move, but the spell bound him in place. He could not even blink or breathe. Unlike before, the sheathed sword did not burst into flame. It wavered, like a reflection in water. Then in the air next to the weapon, a transparent apparition appeared. A perfect glowing likeness of Brisinga, free of its sheath. As well made as was the sword itself, and Aragorn had never found so much as a single flaw. The duplicate floating before him was even more refined. It was as if he was seeing the idea of the sword, an idea that not even Runan, with all her experience working metal, could hope to capture. As soon as the manifestation became visible,
Aragorn was again able to breathe and move. He maintained the spell for several seconds, so he could marvel at the beauty of the summoning, and then he let the spell slip free of his grasp, and the ghostly sword slowly faded into oblivion. In its absence, the inside of the tent seemed unexpectedly dark. Only then did Aragorn again become aware of Saphira and Gleda pressing against his consciousness, watching with steadfast attentiveness every thought that flickered through his mind. Both of the dragons were as tense as Aragorn had ever felt them. If he were to poke Saphira, he guessed she would be so startled she would twist herself in circles.
"And if I were to poke you, nothing would be left but a spear," she commented.
Aragorn smiled and lowered himself onto the cot, tired. In his mind, Aragorn heard a sound like wind rushing across a lonely plain as Gleda relaxed.
"You did well, Shadeslayer."
Gleda's praise surprised Aragorn. The old dragon had given out few enough compliments since he had begun teaching Aragorn.
"But let us not try it again."
Aragorn shivered and rubbed his arms, trying to dispel the cold that had crept into his limbs. "Agreed, master." It was not an experience he was eager to replicate. Still, he felt a deep sense of satisfaction. He had proven without a doubt that there was at least one thing in Alagazia that he could do as well as anyone possibly could, and that gave him hope. On the morning of the third day, Roran arrived back at the Varden, along with his companions, tired, wounded, and travel-worn. Roran's return stirred the Varden from their torpor for a few hours. He and the others with him were given a hero's welcome, but an air of boredom soon settled over the majority of the Varden again. Aragorn was relieved to see Roran. He had known his cousin was safe, as he had scried him several times while he was gone. Nevertheless, seeing him in person freed Aragorn of an anxiety that until that very moment he had not realized he was carrying. Roran was the only family he had left. Murtagh did not count as far as Aragorn was concerned, and Aragorn could not bear the thought of losing him. Now, seeing Roran up close, Aragorn was shocked by his appearance. He had expected Roran and the others to be exhausted, but Roran seemed far more haggard than his companions. He looked as if he had aged 5 years over the course of the trip. His eyes were red and dark-ringed, his brow was lined, and he moved stiffly, as if every inch of his body was covered in bruises. And then there was his beard, which had been burned half off, and which now had a mottled, mangy appearance. The five men, one less than their original number, went first to visit the healers of Duvrangagata, where the spellcasters attended to their wounds. Then they presented themselves to Nasawada in her pavilion. After commending them for their bravery, Nasawada dismissed all of the men, except Roran, whom she asked to deliver a detailed account of his journey to and from Aros, as well as the capture of the city itself. The telling took some time, but both Nasawada and Aragorn, who were standing by her right hand, listened with rapt and sometimes horrified attention while Roran spoke. When he finished, Nasawada surprised both him and Aragorn by announcing that she was placing Roran in charge of one of the Varden's battalions. Aragorn expected the news to please Roran. Instead, he saw the lines in his cousin's face deepen and his brows draw together in a frown. Roran made no objection or complaint, however, but bowed and said in his rough voice, "As you wish, Lady Nasawada." Later, Aragorn walked Roran to his tent, where Katrina was waiting for them. She greeted Roran with such an obvious display of emotion that Aragorn averted his eyes, embarrassed. With Saphira, the three of them dined together, but Aragorn and Saphira excused themselves as soon as they could, for it was obvious that Roran had no energy for company, and Katrina wished to have him for herself. As he and Saphira wandered through the camp in the deepening dusk, Aragorn heard someone behind him shout, "Aragorn! Aragorn! Wait a moment!" He turned to see the thin, gangly figure of the scholar Jode running toward him, strands of hair flying around his lean face. In his left hand, Jode clutched a ragged scrap of parchment. "What is it?" Aragorn asked, worried.
this!" exclaimed Jod, his eyes gleaming. He held up the parchment and shook it. "I've done it again, Aragorn! I've found a way!" In the fading light, the scar on his scalp and temple appeared startlingly pale against his tanned skin.
"You've done what again? You've found what way? Slow down! You're not making sense!"
Jod glanced around furtively. Then he leaned close to Aragorn and whispered,
"All my reading and searching has paid off. I've discovered a hidden tunnel that leads straight into Drasleona."
Decisions. "Explain it to me again," said Nasawada. Aragorn shifted his weight, impatient, but he held his tongue. From the piles of scrolls and books in front of him, Jod picked up a slim volume bound in red leather and began his narrative for the third time. "Some 500 years ago, as best I can tell," Jormungandr interrupted him with a motion of his hand.
"Leave out your qualifiers. We know this is speculation,"
Jod began again.
"Some 500 years ago, Queen Fauna sent Erst Greybeard to Drasleona, or rather what was to become Drasleona."
"And why did she send him?" asked Nasawada, while she toyed with the fringe of her sleeve.
"The dwarves were in the midst of a clan war, and Fauna hoped that she could secure the support of our race by helping King Radgar with the planning and construction of the fortifications for the city, even as the dwarves engineered the defences for Aros."
Nasawada rolled a strand of cloth between her fingers.
"And then Dolgarth Halfstave killed Fauna." "Aye! And Erst Greybeard had no choice but to return to the Beor Mountains as fast as he could to defend his clan from Halfstay's predations."
"But,"
Jod held up a finger,
"before he left, it seems Erst did start on his work. King Radgar's chief advisor, Lord Yardley, wrote in his memoirs that Erst had begun to draw up plans for the sewer system underneath the center of the city, since that would affect how the fortifications would be built."
From his place at the far end of the table that filled the middle of Nasawada's pavilion, Oryk nodded and said,
"That's true enough. You have to work out where and how the weight is distributed and determine what's appropriate for the kind of earth you're dealing with. Otherwise, you're liable to have cave-ins."
Jod continued,
"Of course, Drasleona doesn't have underground sewers, so I assume that nothing like Erst's plans were ever put into effect. However, a few pages later, Yardley says..."
Peering down his nose at the book, Jod read,
"And in a most lamentable turn of events, the Reavers burned many a house and made off with many a family treasure. The soldiers were slow to respond, for they had been put to work underground, labouring like common peasants."
Jod lowered the book.
"Now, what were they excavating? I was unable to find any further mention of subterranean activities in or around Drasleona until..."
Putting down the red volume, he selected another book, this one a massive wood-panelled tome, nearly a foot thick.
"I happened to be perusing the Acts of Taradas and other mysteries of occult phenomena as recorded throughout the ages of men, dwarves, and the most ancient elves, when..."
"It is a work filled with mistakes," said Arya.
She stood by the left side of the table, leaning on both hands over a map of the city.
"The author knew little of my people, and what he did not know, he invented."
"That may be," said Jod. "But he knew a great deal about humans, and it is humans we are interested in."
Jod opened the book close to the middle and gently lowered the upper half to the table, so it lay flat.
"During his investigations, Othman spent some time in this region. He mainly studied Helgrind and the strange happenings associated with it. But he also had this to say about Drasleona. The people of the city also often complain of peculiar sounds and odours wafting up from under their streets and floors, especially at night, which they attribute to ghosts and spirits and other uncanny creatures. But if they are spirits, they are unlike any I have heard of before, as spirits elsewhere seem to avoid enclosed spaces."
Jod closed the book.
Fortunately, Othman was nothing if not thorough, and he marked the locations of the sounds on a map of Drasleona, where, as you can see, they form a nearly straight line through the old part of the city. And you think this indicates the presence of a tunnel? Said Nasawada.
It was a statement, not a question.
I do, said Jode, bobbing his head.
Sitting next to Nasawada, King Orin, who had said little, spoke.
Nothing you have shown us so far, good man Jode, has yet to prove that this is actually a tunnel. If there is a space under the city, it might very well be a cellar or a catacomb, or some other chamber that only leads to the building above. Even if it is a tunnel, we do not know if it exists anywhere outside of Drasleona, nor, assuming its existence, where it would lead. To the heart of the palace, perhaps? What's more, by your own account, it's likely the construction of this hypothetical tunnel was never completed in the first place.
It seems unlikely it could be anything but a tunnel, given its shape, Your Majesty, said Jode. No cellar or catacomb would be so narrow or long. As for whether it was completed, we know it was never used for its intended purpose, but we also know that it lasted at least up until Othman's time, which means the tunnel or passageway or what have you must have been finished to some degree, otherwise the seep of water would have destroyed it long ago.
What of the exit, then? Or the entrance, if you will? Asked the king.
Jode scrabbled among the piles of scrolls for a few moments, before pulling out another map of Drasleona, this one showing a portion of the surrounding landscape.
That I can't be sure about, but if it does lead out of the city, then it would exit somewhere around here.
He placed his index finger on a spot close to the eastern side of the city. Most of the buildings outside the walls that protected the heart of Drasleona were located on the western side of the city, next to the lake. This meant that the location Jode was pointing at, though empty land, was closer to the center of Drasleona than one could get from any other direction without encountering buildings.
But it's impossible to tell without going there to look for it in person.
Aragorn frowned. He had thought Jode's discovery would be more certain.
You are to be congratulated on your research, good man Jode, said Nasawada. You may have once again performed a great service for the Varden.
She rose from her high-backed chair and walked over to look at the map. The hem of her dress rustled as it dragged across the ground.
If we send a scout to investigate, we risk alerting the Empire to our interest in that area. Assuming the tunnel exists, it would be of little value to us then. Murtagh and Thorn would be expecting us on the other end.
She looked at Jode.
How wide do you think this tunnel would be? How many men could fit in it?
I couldn't say. It might be...
Oric cleared his throat, then said,
The earth here is soft and clay-like, with a fair bit of silt layered through it. Horrible for tunnelling. If Erst had any sense, he wouldn't have planned to have one large channel carry away the city's waste. He would have laid down several smaller passageways to reduce the likelihood of a cave-in. I'd guess that none of them would be wider than a yard or so.
Too narrow for more than a single man to pass through at a time, said Jode.
Too narrow for more than a single Nurla, added Oric.
Nasawada returned to her seat and stared at the map with unfocused eyes, as if she were gazing at something far away.
After a few moments of silence, Aragorn said, I could search for the tunnel. I know how to hide myself with magic. The sentries would never see me.
Perhaps, murmured Nasawada. But I still don't like the idea of having you or anyone else running about. The likelihood of the Empire noticing is too high. What if Murtagh is watching? Could you fool him? Do you even know what he is capable of now?
She shook her head. No, we must act as if the tunnel exists and make our decisions accordingly. If events prove otherwise, it won't have cost us anything. But if the tunnel is there, it should allow us to capture Drasleona once and for all.
What have you in mind? Asked King Orin in a tone of caution.
Something bold, Something unexpected.
Aragorn snorted softly. Perhaps you should consult Roran, then.
I have no need of Roran's help in devising my plans, Aragorn.
Nasawara fell silent again, and everyone in the pavilion, including Aragorn, waited to see what she would come up with. At last she stirred and said,
This. We send a small team of warriors to open the gates from the inside.
And how's anyone supposed to manage that?
Demanded Oric.
It would be tricky enough if all they had to face were the hundreds of soldiers stationed in the area. But in case you have forgotten, there's also a giant, fire-breathing lizard lounging close by, and he's sure to take an interest in anyone foolish enough to pry open the gates. And that's not even taking Murtagh into account.
Before the discussion could devolve, Aragorn said, I can do it.
The words had an immediate, chilling effect on the conversation. Aragorn expected Nasawada to reject his suggestion out of hand, but she surprised him by considering it. Then she surprised him further when she said,
Very well.
All the arguments Aragorn had built up fell away as he stared at Nasawada with astonishment. She had obviously followed the same chain of reasoning as he had. The tent erupted into a confusion of overlapping voices as everyone began to speak at once. Arya won out over the din.
Nasawada, you cannot allow Aragorn to endanger himself so. It would be unconscionable. Send some of Blodgarm's spellcasters instead. I know they would agree to help, and they are as mighty warriors as any you can find, including Aragorn.
Nasawada shook her head.
None of Galbatorix's men would dare kill Aragorn. Not Murtagh, not the king's pet magicians, not even the lowest of soldiers. We should use that to our advantage. Besides, Aragorn is our strongest spellcaster, and it may require a great deal of strength to force open the gates. Of all of us, he has the best chance of success. What if he is captured, though? He can't hold his own against Murtagh, you know that. We'll distract Murtagh and Thorn, and that will give Aragorn the opportunity he needs.
Arya lifted her chin.
How? How will you distract them? We'll make as though to attack Dras Leona from the south. Saphira will fly around the city setting buildings on fire and killing soldiers on the walls. Thorn and Murtagh will have no choice but to give chase, especially since it will appear as if Aragorn is riding Saphira the whole time. Blodgarm and his fellow spellcasters can conjure up a facsimile of Aragorn, as they did before. As long as Murtagh doesn't get too close, he'll never discover our subterfuge. You are determined in this?
I am.
Arya's face hardened.
Then I will accompany Aragorn.
Relief seeped through Aragorn. He had hoped she would go with him, but he had been uncertain whether to ask, for fear she would refuse. Nasawada sighed.
You are Islanzadi's daughter. I would not like to place you in such danger. If you were to die, remember how your mother reacted when she thought Durza had killed you. We cannot afford to lose the help of your people. My mother.
Arya clamped her lips shut, cutting herself off.
Then began anew. I can assure you, Lady Nasawada, Queen Islanzadi shall not abandon the Varden, whatever may happen to me. Of that you need have no concern. I will accompany Aragorn, as will two of Blodgarm's spellcasters.
Nasawada shook her head.
No, you can only take one. Murtagh is familiar with the number of elves who have been protecting Aragorn. If he notices that two or more are missing, he may suspect a trap of some sort. In any event, Saphira will need as much help as she can get if she's to keep out of Murtagh's grasp. Three people are not enough to attempt such a mission, insisted Arya. We would be unable to ensure Aragorn's safety, much less open the gates. Then one of Duvrangar Gata can go with you as well.
A hint of derision colored Arya's expression.
None of your spellcasters are strong or skilled enough. We'll be outnumbered 100-1 or worse. Both ordinary swordsmen and trained magicians will be arrayed against us. Only elves or riders.
Or shades,
Oric rumbled.
Or shades, Arya conceded, though Aragorn could tell she was irritated. Only those could hope to prevail against such odds, and even then it is no sure thing. Let us take two of Blodgarm's spellcasters. No one else is fit for the task, not among the Varden.
Oh, and what am I, chopped liver?
Everyone turned to look, surprised, as Angela stepped forward from a corner at the back of the tent. Aragorn had not even suspected she was there.
What a strange expression, said the herbalist. Who would compare themselves to chopped liver in the first place? If you have to choose an organ, why not pick a gallbladder or a thymus gland instead? Much more interesting than a liver. Or what about chopped... She smiled. Well, I suppose that's not important.
She stopped in front of Arya and looked up at her.
Will you object if I accompany you, Alpha? I'm not a member of the Varden, not strictly speaking, but I'm still willing to round out this quartet of yours.
Much to Aragorn's surprise, Arya bowed her head and said,
Of course, wise one. I meant no offence. It would be an honour to have you with us.
Good, exclaimed Angela. That is, assuming you don't mind,
directing her words to Nasuada. Appearing somewhat bemused, Nasuada shook her head.
If you are willing, and neither Aragorn nor Arya objects, then I can think of no reason why you shouldn't go.
I can't imagine why you'd want to, though. Angela tossed her curls.
Do you expect me to explain every decision I make? Oh, very well. If it'll satisfy your curiosity, let's say I have a grudge against the priests of Helgrind, and I'd like the chance to do them some mischief. And besides, if Murtagh puts in an appearance, I have a trick or two up my sleeve that might give him a bit of a turn.
We should ask Elva to go with us as well, said Aragorn. If anyone can help us avoid danger. Nasuada frowned.
Last we spoke, she made her position clear enough. I'll not go bowing and scraping to her in an attempt to convince her otherwise.
I'll talk with her, said Aragorn. I'm the one she's angry with, and I'm the one who should ask her. Nasuada plucked at the fringe of her golden dress. She rolled several strands between her fingers, then abruptly said,
Do as you wish. I dislike the thought of sending a child, even one as gifted as Elva, into battle. However, I suppose she is more than capable of protecting herself. As long as the pain of those around her doesn't overwhelm her, said Angela. The last few battles have left her curled in a ball, barely able to move or breathe.
Nasuada stilled her fingers and peered at Aragorn with a serious expression.
She's unpredictable. If she does choose to go along, be careful of her, Aragorn.
I will, he promised. Then Nasuada began to discuss questions of logistics with Orin and Oric, and Aragorn withdrew somewhat from the conversation, for he had little to contribute. In the privacy of his mind, he reached out to Saphira, who had been listening through him to the goings-on.
Well, he asked, what do you think? You've been awfully quiet. I thought for sure you would say something when Nasuada proposed sneaking into Drasleona.
I said nothing, because I had nothing to say. It is a good plan.
You agree with her?
We are no longer awkward younglings, Aragorn. Our enemies may be fearsome, but so are we. It is time we remind them of that.
Does it bother you that we'll be apart?
Of course it bothers me,
she growled.
Wherever you go, enemies flock to you like flies to flesh. However, you are not as helpless as you once were.
And she almost seemed to purr.
Me? Helpless?
He said with mock outrage.
Only a little bit. But your bite is more dangerous than before.
So is yours.
I go to hunt. A wing-breaking storm is building, and I'll not have a chance to eat again until after we attack.
Fly safely, he said.
As he felt her presence receding from him, Aragorn returned his attention to the conversation within the tent, for he knew his life and that of Saphira would depend on the decisions Nasuada, Oric, and Orin would make.